Refinance activity is heating up. Are your originators ready to capture the opportunity? Join Optimal Blue experts Jared Sammy and Brennan O'Connell on October 7th at 1 p.m. Central for a live webinar, Refi Revival: Stay Ahead of the Curve with Originator Intelligence. You'll discover how to surface high-potential refinance leads from your closed loan data, reconnect with past borrowers using timely, data-driven outreach, and cut research time from 30 minutes to just one click. Register now with the link in the show notes for this episode to give your team the edge in quarter four and beyond. In case you missed it, Optimal Blue has announced the dates for its 2026 summit. Join us February 23rd to 25th at Talking Stick Resort and Conference Center in Scottsdale, Arizona, for a client-exclusive event packed with strategic insight and innovation. Attendees will gain early access to Optimal Blue's latest generative AI and automation tools, dive into expert-led sessions on pricing, compliance, and more, and experience hands-on demos of new capabilities. Plus, it's a chance to connect with capital markets pros, integration partners, and mortgage insiders, all while gaining actionable strategies to maximize profitability and sharpen your competitive edge. The Optimal Blue Summit, where proven mortgage expertise meets modern innovation to shape what's next. Early bird registration is now open at summit.optimalblue.com. Space is limited, so register today. Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome to Optimal Insights. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Vice President of Hedging and Trading Client Services at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode. Welcome, everybody. Hope you had a wonderful long July 4th weekend. We're back here Monday, July 7th, already deep into the hottest month of the year. I got a really good show today. As always, you know, in the interest of keeping you informed, especially the things we need to know as originators and hedgers, we're going to talk about some market items today. So we're going to go with just one long segment here. We're going to, you know, give you a little market update on what happened last week. Of course, we had the jobs report, which was on an odd Thursday, came in pretty healthy, you know, probably shot down the thought of a rate cut here at the end of July by the Fed. So anyway, we'll dive a little bit deeper into that, but also look at just some of the items we've talked about on the podcast over the past couple of months, just these concepts that are kind of all coming together to put upward pressure on rates. And we'll put all of that kind of in a similar context. And then some thoughts on what might cause rates to fall. Like, what would those scenarios look like? Speaking of rates, OBMMI hovering around 6.7. So we had a little bit of a reprieve and then we bounced back up a little bit. Still below the average that we've seen here in the recent months, but just stubbornly above 6.5%. And again, after the jobs report last week, Seems unlikely we'll get a cut, almost impossible to get a cut here at the next Fed meeting unless something significant changes. And even September's meeting, which has kind of been the one we've all been watching for an obvious opportunity to cut, I think that one's in question as well. Still, odds are there will be a cut in September, at least if you look at the CME Fed tracker. So the money is on some sort of cut by then, but obviously it'll depend on what happens with inflation related to tariffs. And, you know, we'll talk a little bit about government spending. There's some big news on that over the weekend that you probably have heard about. Anyway, we'll get into all that and more here in a few minutes. Volume is still good, though, in our industry. Not a lot of lights flashing there. I know the last couple summers, we've all been a little bit disappointed with the home buying season, but, you know, seeing a decent uptick there over last year and also seeing refis continue to grow just as people need to unlock equity from their homes in different ways. So seeing refi numbers pretty healthy this year, and that's kind of tracking along with what the MBA has been predicting. All right, let's go over and talk with Kevin and Alex about what's going on in the market. All right, welcome, Kevin, Alex. Good to see you. Hope you had a good fourth weekend. And obviously we were all kind of paying attention to the news over the past 4 or 5 days, a lot going on. Let's just get into it. So Alex, important numbers. Always, the labor report is always an important one, right? And that kind of, on its face, right, it was a very short trading day on Thursday. Unemployment report comes out 8:30 a.m. Eastern time. And right off the bat, it looks bad for rates, right? It looks good. Let's say it looks good for the labor market. Comes in a little bit hot, kind of in line with where we've seen it the last few months, but you've read a little bit deeper into it. And there's some facts in there that I think are important.
Definitely. Yeah. No, I hope you had a happy fourth as well. And on the face of it, as you noted just a moment ago, this labor report was looked extremely strong when you look at the headline number, and it really decimated any chances when you look at the CME Fed Watch for rate cuts in July. 95% for a stay in July now, and 60% in September. So just creeping down on that side. But yeah, looking a little bit deeper beyond the headline number, it looked really strong. 146,000 new jobs, well above estimates. The unemployment rate, which was expected to tick up 0.1%, stayed where it was at 4.1%. So it looked really healthy. But the caveat there is private payrolls, which is really the driver of growth in the economy, was only 73,000 of that 140. And a big chunk of that remaining of the new public sector payrolls were in education space. And this is really a seasonality effect in effect here, because this is the time of the year that school teachers are being hired for next year. And I think it's great that we're hiring more teachers, get those teacher student ratios down. But on the face of it, I think this is like a one-time standout month, because they're not going to be hiring more teachers next month or the month after. Definitely, I think that cushioned a lot of the market reaction. By the end of the day, we were pretty flat in the bond markets. So we'll just got to keep an eye on it. Looking towards next week, I'm going to continue to say, just keep an eye on that initial jobless claims, that until we see an uptick, as we've been saying, until we see an uptick in the unemployment rate, there's really no fire that needs to be addressed in regards to getting rate cuts outside our industry. Our industry would love to see more volume, and we're all dying for more volume. But from a full U.S. economy standpoint, there's smoke, but there's no fire, as we keep saying.
Yeah, no, it does feel like, even with those nuances of the report, right, a little bit coincidental that there's all this local and government hiring this month. Still doesn't look great, but private payrolls are still building somewhat, even in the face of all these headwinds we keep talking about. So
yeah, it's good to see we're seeing private payrolls expand, but that 73,000 in private payrolls that we saw was the weakest since October. And in October was a jobs report that was heavily impacted by the Southeast storms that were happening last fall, September into October. And to see that week of hiring without, a natural disaster or some obvious natural input, that, a one-off situation, I think that is a definite sign of weakness there.
Right. Just kind of scraping the bottom at this point, waiting for that negative number potentially to come in late summer or fall. Before we get into big, beautiful bill, tariff deadlines, what's coming up this week?
It's a pretty quiet week. There's some consumer credit numbers on Tuesday, and there's initial jobless claims. Again, I would really keep an eye on the initial jobless claims and in consumer credit to an extent. That's going to, I think we've seen an emerging trend of weaker consumer sentiment, consumer spending. And if we start to see cracks in the credit model, those would all be more signs that the consumer is under pressure.
Right. Yeah. The jobless number, the jobless claims number is a good one to watch. Every Thursday, by the way, if you're listening, if you did not realize that, every Thursday that number comes out, and it basically represents people who have applied for benefits, for unemployment benefits. So it could be a really good real-time indicator of what the jobs market looks like.
Yep. Far more timely than that non-farm that everyone keeps an eye on. So it's a good one.
Yep. But then next week, which we'll talk more about this next Monday, we do have the inflation numbers coming in, which really at this point should start showing some signs of tariff impact if it's going to happen, right?
Yeah, you would think so. They were pretty strong last month, and by strong I mean lower in regards to inflation. But yeah, you would expect to see some sort of tariff impact at this point. Again, we're floating at lower tariff levels, I think, but the overall tariff level is of the 2024 import mix somewhere just a little bit south of 20%. So I would expect to see some inflationary pressure there. Again, everyone that loaded up their warehouses in the early spring in anticipation of these tariffs, those warehouses are got to be scraping the barrel. We keep saying scraping the barrel on this cast, but I would expect the same in regards to inventories.
Right. So everybody who kind of tried to stock up or dig through the corners of the warehouse to figure out what they could sell that they had bought before tariffs were pretty quickly imposed after the inauguration. Yeah, those goods have got to be gone, or you'd think they'd start bleeding the tariffs into the price, so there's not such a shock when the new Nikes come in,
Right. Yep. Yeah. And you see headlines every now and then about how Walmart or Amazon, whoever it was, is you know, notating what percentage of the price was being offset by tariffs. But yeah, I think by and large, it doesn't seem to have bled in yet. But this is kind of the inflection point. A lot of economists are saying June, July, somewhere in there. We'll have to see. Something's got to break at a certain point. But while we're on the topic of tariffs.
Yeah, let's stay on this for a minute.
Yeah, today's the day. We should be seeing those reciprocal tariffs going into effect today. But over the weekend, they pushed that out to August 1st. So we've got an additional 23, 24, 25 days for them to negotiate. And it was a blanket exemption. So everyone across the board that doesn't have a trade deal yet is remaining at their current tariff levels and not the very high ones that we saw put into effect on April 2nd. So they're still negotiating. They're getting close on some of the big ones. Those Southeast trading partners, we got one done with Vietnam. I think, you know, Cambodia and Laos, a lot of textiles come from there. I think those would be big ones to get. And then they got a framework out of London several weeks ago. It seems like a lifetime ago with all that happened during June, especially in the Middle East. But there is a framework there. It needs to be reviewed by Xi and Trump. And the fact that it's kind of bled away from the headlines, I kind of wonder if they're going to have to go back to the table on that one. Maybe someone doesn't like something in there. Otherwise, they would have signed it at this point because, I mean, they're looking for deals, right? And China's a big one. So we'll have to see. I that one might be going back to the drawing board, but we'll see.
Yeah, it could be the biggest one. Probably, you know, the biggest in terms of the headlines. And but yeah, we're getting, you know, Vietnam got done. Like you said, there's with these continued extensions of the deadline, we are actually seeing some deals get done. So I think that's encouraging that we're getting to a spot where we can just start doing the math and seeing what it does to the, you know, to the inflation numbers.
Yeah, I think, you know, and we've talked about this before, but the average trade deal timeframe, historically looking back, is like a year and a half it takes to really do these deals. And so they're doing them at a highly accelerated timeframe. But it does seem like there's progress being made. I think, Alex, to your point, I think focusing on frameworks is probably something that we're going to end up seeing more of, because that allows you to kind of front load 80%, let's say, of the agreement and then iron out that last 20% behind closed doors. But, you know, the market sees the headline, the market sees the momentum, and then a lot of the logistics, a lot of the painful, you know, things around how are we going to handle, you know, this section of goods or that section of goods. At the end of the day, I think the markets are mostly looking for, is there willingness to get something done? Can they agree in principle? And the headlines are really driving that. So probably, you know, going to see more of that later this summer, but it might not be, you know, the full scope of, you know, what we might normally see in a trade deal. That might take longer, but the net effect is probably still going to be the same.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think frameworks are going to be the way a lot of countries are going to want to go, just because Bessent has indicated they'll kick the can on this as long as they need to for each individual country, so long as they're negotiating in good faith. And I think having a framework, which doesn't, you know, that's not tying you down to anything, but it does prove that you are negotiating and that you can come to the table with some sort of give. So I'm with you, Kevin. I think we'll see a lot of frameworks.
Yeah, I think, you know, one other interesting thing to watch too, I know you mentioned now is sort of the inflection point for our tariffs going to have an impact broad-based on U.S. goods. I think there was a lot of anxiety about this early on after the tariffs went into effect, just given the size, you know, the magnitude of the tariffs that are out there. We got to remember that those were rolled back significantly within a few weeks. So while there is still, you know, a net effect of tariffs, it just gives companies, I think, much more flexibility, given, you know, that's a much, much smaller magnitude, to figure out ways to avoid passing those costs off, you know, potentially for longer, or, you know, just kind of working through, you know, whatever the logistics are to potentially avoid moving those on down the chain. So I think, you know, important reminder just that the tariffs are not the original tariffs that we're talking about. They've been scaled back significantly.
Yep. Scaled back. And one of the Trump administration, one of their big talks they want to hit on is transshipments. You know, this was a big workaround that China employed during the first trade war, during the first Trump administration, where they would ship items first to Vietnam and then Vietnam would send them onwards to the United States. They're looking to address this with all these trade deals. In fact, in the Vietnam deal that was done, it specifically, anything that is transshipped via Vietnam has a higher rate there. But I'm with you. I think while there's no frameworks in effect, I think a lot of companies are taking advantage of, they're looking at each individual country and where they can ship things through to get the lowest possible rate.
Yeah, I saw some headlines in the last week or so about transshipping. So maybe just, you know, sort of explaining what that is for the audience and kind of how this factors into the overall, you know, situation internationally. So transshipping is like you mentioned, when, you know, you're moving goods from, let's say, China to Vietnam, then going to the US. But today there's a provision that allows companies, if they're substantially changing the product within the country of, you know, Vietnam, let's say, they're going to get subject to the, you know, Vietnamese tariffs and not the Chinese tariffs, but the money sort of flows in the same way. So I think there's some perception out there that there are a lot of companies who are kind of saying that they're materially changing.
You
know, yeah, exactly. but they're really just mostly just, you know, docking the ship and, you know, whatever that they do to sort of get around it. And so they're looking at potentially expanding the scope of when, you know, tariffs from the originated country would apply and really limiting the scope of, you know, what it means to, you know, fundamentally transform the product or the widget or what have you. Definitely that's a tricky thing to implement for sure once you start getting a little bit more into the weeds on that. But definitely another thing to watch in terms of global shipping and how that, you know, might potentially affect supply chains or anything.
Yeah. I mean, how do you police that? If you're not proactive about it, you kind of have to wait for a bad actor to stick out. And then I guess you put sanctions on that bad actor, right? Rather than have actual inspections in these foreign ports trying
to figure out. Yeah, we're not in there. Like, yeah, we're not in Vietnam to go to go say, oh, are they materially changing this or not? So
are they just changing the label on it and saying that, you know, now it's made in Vietnam and send it along?
That's exactly what they were doing during the first administration. The first administration was a gold mine for Vietnam because mm-hmm. it's right over the border from China. A lot of capital inflows from China as they built factories there to make their goods there.
Right. This could be a boon for some of those countries, but once again, if it's done the right way, if they're actually making some, you know, like you said, making changes, the textiles come from China and the shirt gets made in Vietnam. That's, you know, you get Vietnam's tariff structure, right?
Yep. They're looking to close that loophole at the end of the day.
Yes. Anything else on tariffs for today? We will be talking about it again next week. I'm sure of that.
Oh, I'm sure we will. This is just kind of coming out this morning, but Trump was threatening an additional 10% tariff on countries aligning themselves with the BRICS bloc. That's kind of the independent non-dollar denominated bloc out there in the world. It stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and Singapore.
Africa, I think.
South Africa. You are right, Kevin. Yes, just kind of a third, kind of making world a little more multipolar in a way. Their biggest complaint is the dollar denominated systems throughout the world. So, you know, anyone moving in that direction, getting threatened with an additional 10% today, but we'll have to see if that comes to any sort of fruition.
Yeah. Interesting story behind this too, because if you look at the value of the US dollar in 2025, it's off to its worst year, I think 50 years or so. It's down about 10% on the year. And so this is the way that I sort of think about this is you kind of have this currency pressure hot potato that you can sort of pass around to different countries. And so we've had this hot potato for the last few years. The US dollar has been very strong. It, you know, went up substantially. I think like I forget the exact amount, but more than it's dropped. And that was when, you know, we saw interest rates go up and everyone was going into, you know, treasuries and looking to pick up some of that risk-free yield. And it's since pulled back. But when the US dollar pulls back, that actually kind of exports that currency pressure to other nations. So you don't want to have overvalued or, you know, slightly overvalued currency, because that's going to hurt your exports. There's all sorts of issues, you know, in terms of central banks being able to counteract that with reserves and what foreign currency reserves do they have. So I think it's an important thing to call out. Why are we seeing the BRICS announce this? You know, our response to this, the broader background context is the falling US dollar. It's down. In some ways, it's beneficial for us. I think there's some arguments on both sides of whether it's a good or bad, but I think relative to the last few years, it's a good thing. You know, how that's affecting other countries and what to expect based on, you know, them taking on more of that currency pressure.
Yeah, it's all the backdrop of, you know, maybe there is some strategic allowing a slight devaluation of the dollar, but at the end of the day, we need it to be the reserve currency of the world, or we have much bigger problems than a little bit of inflation from tariffs or whatever, you know, or a growing deficit. I think it would obviously make things worse. That's why why the administration announced this potential additional tariff on nations that drop the dollar, because that would obviously have a big impact on the supply of dollars that are out there and you know, start to devalue the dollar even more if you see the BRICS countries walking away from it completely.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the parallels you see people drawing is to the 1980s. And there was an official kind of devaluing of the US dollar that occurred because a lot of our partners, France, Japan, in the 1980s were complaining the dollar was way too strong. And that resulted in the Plaza Accords where it wasn't like this where the market was kind of dictating that the dollar was going to come down, but it was much more central bank policy went out there with the explicit goal of lowering the value of the dollar relative to those partners.
Well, speaking of value of the dollar, kicking the can down the road, all the things we've been covering here, big, beautiful bill passed on the 4th of July, was signed on the 4th of July as was the goal of the administration. So that drama is essentially done. Now it's, I think, just up to, you know, the representatives to kind of sell it to the nation before the next election, right? Like what all was in this thing? Everyone's still kind of digesting that. Everything happened so quickly. Certainly for me, reading about it every day and what's getting cut out, what's getting added, what's getting changed as it moved through the House and Senate and the final votes, a lot going on there. But at the end of the day, it technically increases the deficit over what the deficit would have been over the next few years, over the next 10 years. So it's adding debt to the world, right? That needs to be purchased by someone. So we'll get to that here in a minute, but generally speaking, what all was in this bill that's of note, you guys think, to our industry or just in general to the, you know, the defense, right? $180 billion, I think, added to defense spending every year, which is obviously an important component. There were a lot of other pieces in there that had to do with tax cuts and just further investment in infrastructure.
Yeah, I think some big headlines coming out. So, because there's a lot in here, it was, you know, 900 something pages, but potentially even longer by the time that it was signed. So there's a lot to digest. But I think, you know, to break it down for the audience, some big things to understand is that the bill is extending the tax cuts that were part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. Those were set to expire after 10 years. So either next year or the year after, were essentially going to go away. So relative to current law, the big, beautiful bill increases the deficit. So it keeps the tax cuts in place and it adds more to the debt than if the tax cuts had expired. But essentially it's really just keeping those in place. I think that's generally what the markets were expecting, relatively speaking. If we were in a situation where all of a sudden all those tax cuts went away, you know, 100%, that would be a pretty significant, you know, fiscal tightening that would happen. So when we hear that we're adding to the debt, it's important to understand that this is relative to tax cuts that were going to expire. And if those had expired all at once, you know, probably would not have been a great thing. But that said, I think there's a very strong argument that the tax cuts that are in place now and are, you know, set to continue are unsustainable relative to our actual fiscal spending. And in the big, beautiful bill, there are spending cuts, pretty significant spending cuts to Medicaid that are projected based on what the law changes. There's new work requirements. There's new, you know, paperwork requirements, more frequent check-ins to make sure that the people there are eligible. So you actually could make an argument, even though, you know, there's going to be a lot of headlines out there that this is adding to the debt, it's adding to the deficit, all of this, relative to current law today in 2025, when this goes into effect, there's an argument to be made. This is kind of fiscal tightening because it's keeping the tax cuts in place that are there today. But then next year, there's going to be a reduction in spending.
Some counterbalance to it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Versus what we're seeing today. So the end result is you kind of have inflation pressures a little bit on both sides. You have an inflation reduction pressure due to the reduction in spending, you know, specifically around Medicaid. And then you have, you know, inflationary pressures that are, you know, pro-inflation due to the growth potentially from continuing the tax cuts and then also just from increasing the debt, which that is kind of the big story, I think, that this bill doesn't tackle and leaves unresolved. You know, the U.S. among developed nations, particularly among large nations, is really right at the top in terms of its debt to GDP ratio. So ahead of the US, which is at about 125%, you know, debt to GDP. You have Japan, which we're about six times the size of Japan. And then Greece and Italy. Greece, not really a big economy. And, you know, Italy, we're, I think, about four times the size of Italy. So we're really, the relatively speaking, there really is a problem to solve there, which this bill does not tackle. But those are some of the big components that you're seeing, you know, coming as a result of this bill passing.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, so that's a very important point, is that in the parallel universe of if the administration were to do nothing, we would have had tax cuts that would have expired, and we would have just kind of had a default reduction of the deficit, which, yes, increasing taxes could be seen as something that's not great. But at the same time, at what point do you start cutting into the deficit when you do find yourself in the company of a handful of developed nations that have deficits as high as ours, or debt versus GDP that's as high as ours, and even a bunch of undeveloped countries like parts of Africa where they're either their inflation is out of control, or they're just trying to grow themselves out of to become a bit more of a developed nation. There's just no political will out there to reduce deficits at this moment. And obviously a lot of debates on why that is and how that works and how perpetuating these tax cuts could actually help us grow as a nation in terms of GDP and grow the other side of the equation, right? Instead of reducing the deficit, increase our actual output, which with things like AI and other, you know, creating jobs and things like that, that's certainly how the U.S. has become, you know, the largest economy in the world.
We'll see how it ultimately ends up playing out, both, you know, economically and politically. But I do think, you know, one big headline coming out here is it doesn't seem like we're quite resolving the debt and deficit issue head on. But at the same time, you know, like you mentioned, as a result of this pro-growth policies, there's a lot of interesting nuggets in there that could potentially move the needle. We'll just, you know, have to wait and see kind of as they're implemented. But a few things particularly relevant to our industry that I thought would be good to highlight that were provisions in the bill. Now, these, relatively speaking, I would say are more minor provisions. So they're sort of, you know, swamped by the tax cuts or spending cut conversation in terms of their magnitude.
Sure, they're relatively inexpensive compared to
exactly
some of these other monster provisions.
Right, when you think about housing or, you know, mortgage industry, I think these are interesting things for folks to be aware of. So the first is the bill actually has the largest housing credit expansion in 25 years. So it raises the low income housing tax credit. And this is really a way to stimulate, it goes to developers, but it's a way to stimulate low income housing. So it gives easier access for financing for developers, so they have to put less cash up front. But the net effect should be an incentive to produce more low income housing, which is, you know, a good thing. The second item is, and this is a pretty interesting one, the Veterans Housing Fund via a buyback tax. So the bill introduces a 1% excise tax on corporate stock buybacks for firms with net worths greater than $10 billion. And it takes that money and that goes to a fund to support housing programs for homeless veterans. And that they project is going to be to the tune of around $12 to $15 billion over 10 years, so $1.5 billion or so, and that will be distributed, you know, via grants, also, you know, stimulating housing construction as well. Some interesting things there, and then also something that's been talked about more often, but the SALT cap deduction, so state and local taxes. That's also if you're a homeowner, you have property taxes. Previously, with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, that cap was 10K, and that's gone up to 40K. So you can now deduct up to 40K for your state and local taxes as well. There was one important component for technology that didn't make it into the bill. It was stripped: the AI regulation freeze. So there was a provision in there at one time that would prevent any state entity from regulating artificial intelligence, and that was removed. So that would have created one federal standard for AI regulation that ultimately was taken out. So some interesting things in there, I think, for the audience to be aware of. One other one I'll throw in there, and this is for anyone who is a homeowner and potentially thinking about going solar. there was a provision in place today. If you going to add solar to your home or buy, you know, a Tesla Powerwall, get, you know, a battery powered backup for your home, that is expiring at the end of the year. If you want to, you know, get solar installed, you know, get yourself a home battery backup, you got to do that before you got to have it installed before the end of the year, or else that goes away. So if you're thinking about doing it, probably get on that and then, you know, take advantage of that 30% off.
Yeah, same with the electric vehicle credit that expires as well. Pretty big difference, because that was, you know, $9,000 for a lot of folks, which you buy one of the more affordable electric vehicles and it kind of pays for it, at least for the first few years. Yeah, so a lot of those things were expenses, you know, for the federal government, and those will drop off. So that's part of the, you know, potential savings side. And yeah, as you mentioned with SALT, a lot of this just sort of, there's like a tide that kind of is pushing a little bit more responsibility and goals and ideas back to, and responsibility back to the states, which is interesting. That was as I recall, was a theme in the first Trump administration, was states' rights being a bit more of an emphasis than which typically happens with Republicans, right? Smaller federal government, you know, that needs to be, a lot of times needs to be taken up somewhere else. It tends to be the states or the local municipalities.
Yeah, one last thing I'll throw out there too is, in case anyone was curious about this, the major housing and mortgage trade groups are all on the record in support of the bill. So that includes the MBA, the National Association of Realtors, the National Association of Home Builders, and several others. So they're all on record in support of the provisions in the big beautiful bill. Generally speaking, that's to be expected for any significant piece of legislation that's expected to pass. You know, trade groups come out on record, but that is, you know, on the record supported by our industry, housing industry, and others.
Right. We've talked about a lot here today, and I will add one more thing that kind of piles on the mountain of debt that's going to be online here in a very short period of time, right? So we have tariffs potentially raising tax revenue. So that's on one side. That could actually reduce deficits, but also could increase prices. So there's a tug of war being played there. We have the big, beautiful bill, which kicks the can down the road in terms of deficits. There's also, and this kind of with all the drama about tariffs and the big, beautiful bill and other things going on in the world recently, may have been a little under the radar, but I find it fascinating that just the agreement that NATO has agreed, all the members of NATO have agreed to significantly increase their defense spending from what was kind of like a, as I understand it, kind of a fluffy 2% target up to a flat 5%. Part of that can be non-lethal spending, and there's some negotiations that happened there. But at the end of the day, it's 5% of GDP, which is potentially a doubling from some NATO nations that were just skirting along around 2%. So that's an enormous amount of debt that may need to flood the market. That's not all deficit spending, but a lot of it is, right? As you mentioned, pretty much all developed nations are working at some sort of deficit right now, including us.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really important point to highlight. And so if we also even take a step back and look at your macro U.S. versus Europe in 2025, I think two major headlines, that headline and then the German government also signaling a significant boost to their own defense spending, have really moved the needle in Europe in terms of both bond yields going up as a result of that, but also asset prices. So year to date, Europe is a better place to be than U.S. assets, partly because of those headlines stimulating their domestic economies with additional spending. Now that's sort of like a both sides of the coin thing, because some more stimulation is good, too much is not good. But European asset prices, European stock indices are outperforming U.S. Stock indices, you know, fairly significantly, even though the U.S. is now back up and you know, hitting all-time highs for, you know, some of the major stock indices. So a lot of interesting things going on in Europe, you know, this year. And I think the NATO headline is really just adding to that story.
Yeah, revving up the engine, right? This is all potentially pro-growth if it's done the right way. When there are government contracts that come along with a lot of this, there's a lot of trade that's going to happen. You know, not everybody makes their own tanks and missiles and jets, right? So there's a lot of trade that's going to be sparked by this. And it's, I think I did a little quick math earlier, and it is roughly a doubling. The NATO budget for defense spending right now is about $1.5 trillion. We're like two-thirds of that, the U.S. is. But that should double over the coming years. So you'd be talking about a $3 trillion budget for defense just across the NATO nations, which is, you know, a majority of the developed world, if you don't, you know, other than basically China and Russia, pick up the rest of what gets spent on these sort of goods. So yeah, we'll see how all that gets taken down. But at the end of the day, it's going to add more debt onto the market. We're adding more through just continued deficit spending, and somebody needs to buy that debt, right? That's the punchline of all of this, is if, you know, the Fed can affect short-term rates overnight, literally, and that might happen here in the second half of the year. But long-term rates are largely determined by supply and demand, and there's just a ton of supply of bonds on the market right now and for the foreseeable decades. So it's likely that those yields will need to be fairly high, unless you have some kind of circumstance where the Fed is forced to come back in and buy bonds, or you have deficits that do get reduced and you actually have, you know, a tightening supply at some point. But right now it just feels like everybody's pro-growth. Everybody's going to be chasing, you know, that growth machine for the next 10 years. And that's just going to keep, you know, keep rates, you know, mortgage rates, unfortunately, probably between 6% and 7%.
Yep. I think that's a big takeaway there is it seems like at this point, there's a potential for mortgage rates to move up in the same way that there is the potential to move down. So, you know, we're sort of just in that space where really could go either way, but, you know, so far this year, it's been fairly consistent.
Yes. And if short-term rates do drop, those arms are going to have legs, Kevin. We're going to bring that back.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
All right. Anything else, gentlemen?
Happy birthday, Jeff McCarty. We're without our fourth wheel today. I hope you're listening on your birthday. Happy birthday.
You may have noticed Jeff is not with us today. He's off today. I'm not sure because of his birthday, but today is Jeff McCarty's birthday. Happy birthday. All right. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Kevin. Thanks, Alex. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks, guys.
All right. Let's wrap this thing up. Great show. Appreciate you, Alex, Kevin. Good conversation, a lot to think about, and a lot more coming up. That's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thank you again for tuning in to Optimal Insights.
Is your technology vendor selling real solutions or just the idea of them? Too often, companies pitch big returns, offer free trials, and promise seamless automation, only to reveal during implementation that the tech doesn't actually exist. At Optimal Blue, we take a different approach. Our AI-powered automation is already live, already delivering, and already saving lenders real dollars. We show you exactly where the ROI comes from and how it reduces risk. No vague timelines, just proven technology that's working in production today. AI at Optimal Blue isn't just about delivering software. It's about empowering lenders to make smarter decisions, operate more efficiently, and stay ahead of the curve. Built around real capital markets challenges, informed by direct engagement with thousands of clients, and focused on delivering measurable value at no additional cost to clients. While others talk about AI, we're delivering it. Innovation that delivers for your bottom line. Learn more at optimalblue.com.